Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. We have done the last month of shows have all been on one subject, and it's kind of great to move back to, I don't know, the meat and potatoes of kind of what the Mormon Matters Podcast does in many ways, really what online Mormonism kind of wrestles with best. And that's the issues of faith transitions, paradigm shifts, looking at things from new angles. You know, we try to be sympathetic and empathetic about the pain and the turmoil of things like this. But hopefully we model through our conversations that there's beauty ahead, that there's richness ahead, that there's depth ahead, even as we may kind of let go of things that perhaps when we were children or even into our, you know, middle and late adulthood, we just hadn't been exposed to things to have us, you know, take a new look. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about we're going to use a couple of words here. We're going to use the word disenchantment, and we're going to use the word demythologizing as two terms here. And in some ways, with the D and the dis, it sounds, again, we're moving away from something else. But we're going to try to talk about these as healthy processes, good processes. And we have three wonderful guests here. Derek Clements has been on the show three different times. Derek, and you're going to kind of lead us out when we get going on disenchantment. Would you introduce yourselves to people and then maybe even just give us a little bit about that pivotal class that some of the material you're going to talk about here? Because I had the same, when I was exposed to that same material, but in grad school where you had it in undergraduate school, it was really fantastic stuff for me too. So talk about a little bit about that after you introduce yourself.
Sure. Great. Well, I live in Provo. Yeah, it's great to be on, Dan. And I'll just say the last, you know, month or so of Mormonism has been kind of difficult. But I've loved what you've done with the show. It's just been really, really helpful for me personally.
Thank you.
So, yeah, I live in Provo. I'm right now teaching English to high school students at a treatment center in Utah. And I also podcast and make stories and kind of that's what I like doing.
Well,
so
tell us about your podcasts and your storytelling shows and things.
So I run the Pixar podcast. So it's an unofficial podcast, but I've long been obsessed with Pixar Animation Studios. And so a few years ago, I started a podcast and ended up interviewing a lot of people that work there and stuff. And I've been able to visit the studios a number of times and interview filmmakers and stuff. So it's really fun for me. Just like kind of a passion project to meet some of my idols and things like that. So that's the Pixar podcast, what I do. In fact, we actually just did an episode about Toy Story because it was the 20th anniversary of Toy Story. And my guest and I just talked for an hour and a half about how that movie is really a model of disenchantment and a metaphor in lots of really interesting ways. So, you know, if that's your thing, if you want more disenchantment discussion after this, you can check that out.
Nice, nice. But tell us about The Porch.
I run The Porch. It's a storytelling show in Provo and sometimes in Salt Lake as well and stuff. But it's basically just live storytelling format. People get up on stage and tell personal true stories, and it's a lot of fun. So, yeah, I'm doing that for a number of years as well. I just love stories and audio and all that stuff.
Well, and I'm going to make our listeners jealous by having you tell them what very cool thing you did a couple of summers ago with I'm sure a favorite podcast of other people. They're going to geek out.
Well, I did live in New York for a summer, and I was an intern at Radiolab. So that was a really, really good opportunity. Really loved that a lot. Learned a lot of stuff.
Jealous. Anyway, thanks so much for being on, brother.
Yeah, it's great to be on.
Jordan Harmon, welcome back. You were on just a few months ago. We talked a little bit about the messages about faith and doubt and things like that that came out of our last general conference. Welcome you back. And please tell us a little bit about your background and kind of any places that you want to go.
Well, thanks, Dan, for having me. My name is Jordan Harmon, as you said, and I live in Provo, Utah. I work at an addiction treatment center and for young adults, and also we work with people with mental health struggles. I'm interested in you know, faith and both in terms of the experience of trying to live a faithful life, and also intellectually, it's, you know, interesting to me, philosophy and theology of how we come to know things and how we come to relate to each other and our ideas and our institutions and communities. And so a lot of these discussions that you have on the podcast are really interesting to me, and I like to read about and think about these issues and
well,
stuff.
So, you're super insightful, and from our pre-conversation, I know you're going to add a ton for us tonight, so thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you. Carl Youngblood, welcome to the podcast. This is your first time. You and I have certainly been friends and acquaintances the last 7 or 8 years through various reasons, but haven't had you on before, but I'm glad to get you. You wrote a paper that came to my attention, and that's and it had the word demythologizing in it. Would you introduce yourself and then a little bit, maybe just tell us a quick little bit about that paper and kind of the stuff that we might discuss later?
Yeah, so I have been, in my professional life, I work as a software engineer, been doing that for about 20 years. I grew up in Provo, Utah, attended BYU, started out as a music major, and kind of started to feel after I got off my mission that I needed to do something more practical, started getting worried and scared based on what all the adults in my life were telling me I should do, and just ended up with computer science and Portuguese. I really had a love for languages, so did that. But found myself constantly on the computer and couldn't get off it, so decided that was trying to tell me something, and ended up with a career in software engineering. But I've always had kind of a personal interest in just exploring things in depth, and fell in love with philosophy after becoming acquainted with some friends with whom I who shared some ideas in philosophy with me, and with whom I co-founded the Mormon Transhumanist Association, a nonprofit organization kind of dedicated to helping to reconcile science and technology and traditional views and religion and things like that.
And you were recently on a podcast, a couple of sections of it, and at least the first section was all about the Mormon Transhumanist Association.
That's right.
It was Thoughtful Faith and James Patterson interviewing you?
That's right. I had a great time with James discussing my interest in transhumanism and what led me to help found the Mormon Transhumanist Association, as well as this topic that we're going to be discussing today. So that's been an ongoing endeavor of ours, and I currently serve as the vice president of the MTA. And I'll just put in a quick plug for our annual conference, which will take place next April at the Provo Library on April 9th. So get excited for that. Mm-hmm. Just briefly, I could just kind of introduce what the paper is about. The title of the paper is Demythologizing Mormonism. And I would say more than anything, the topic is about what to do when you discover challenging issues or weaknesses or flaws in your personal life narrative, whatever that happens to be. And the paper discusses various approaches to those challenges and some of the results of different ways of approaching it, and also some ways of sort of fruitfully working through these challenges to our faith or even our just worldview.
Yeah, and your paper kind of deals with both how to do it personally, but then you have a great section on as an institution wrestling with these kinds of things too.
Yeah, we get into that as well. So I'd be happy to discuss that here.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, it's a great paper. Is there any more that you wanted to say about it? I interrupted you. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Okay. I think that's a good brief introduction. If you want me to go into more detail, I can. But
no, we're fine. I felt like I cut you off. So.
Oh yeah. Good. No problem.
All right. Well, let's just dive in, and I'm going to throw to Derek first. And Derek, I kind of teased in your bio to ask you a little bit about a class that you took. Is that where you'd want to start the discussion about just this really interesting material that you encountered in Native American spirituality, and do you want to go out from there, or is that where you'd like to start today?
Yeah, that would be great. And yeah, sorry that I forgot to mention that, and I should never forget that, because the class was taught by Suzanne Lundquist. I don't think she's still at BYU. I graduated a couple of years ago. She was always every semester saying this was her last semester that she was going to teach, but she was right on the edge of retiring, and she just is one of the best sort of souls in my path so far, because she really helped me think through a lot of issues. I had a lot of great professors at BYU in like the English department in particular, that really helped me, you know, come to some ideas. There are just some amazing scholars there that can think deeply about faith, and that helped me a lot. But this class in particular, the first class that I took from her, I actually took a number of them, and the first one that I took was Native American literature, and she is an expert on Native American literature. She did a lot of her own scholarly studies back in the day on the subject. But one of the cool things that she did in that class was she kind of talked right at the very beginning of class. She talked about 2 Nephi 29, where there's this prophecy of the last days when people will be sort of apostate. And the way that it talks about the apostasy of that time is that everybody seems to be kind of religiously certain in a way, and sort of satisfied with what they have. And there's the whole passage that is, you know, a Bible, we already have a Bible. And I always grew up understanding that passage of, you know, kind of a dig at other Christians who might not accept the Book of Mormon because we already have a Bible or something. But she really illuminated how if the Book of Mormon is written, you know, for members of the church as well as everybody, then that message is pretty important for Mormons as well. And that sometimes we can have a tendency to think that we already have the whole truth. But in fact, in 2 Nephi 29, it's this beautiful sort of illustration of the Lord speaking to all people. And it's very strong language that the Lord will speak to the people in the north and in the west and in the south and in the east and everywhere. And the sort of the end goal would be that everybody brings their truth together from this passage, from these chapters. And so she sort of set that out right at the beginning of the semester, saying like, look, we're going to dive into Native American culture, Native American literature, and there are some things that we can learn you know, God speaks to different people in different ways. And that was just a really helpful insight for me to sort of let go of some of my, you know, because I had been wrestling for a while with some issues with my faith and how I was seeing things. That just gave me some really good language. And then I could dive in now to talk about the disenchantment stuff with the Native American culture, or we can save that for later. Where would you like?
No, yeah, that's where I want to go.
Okay.
Basically, as I kind of framed at the beginning, there is something, you know, there's along a life path, we have to start relating to our religions and our beliefs and things differently. And so that's the big framing. And right in these Native American cultures that you are going to talk about right now, something is built right in it that I have a little bit of holy envy for.
Yes.
So will you introduce what that is?
And absolutely. Then,
yeah, please.
And I'm gonna refer to an article by Sam Gill. Sam Gill is one of the scholars that Suzanne Lundquist referred to a lot. And by the way, every class that I took from her, she found a way to work this in, which I thought was really smart. I think that she is aware of the fact that college is a place where people are encountering new ideas and having challenges to faith. And so she really tries to work in some of these ideas into a lot of I took, you know, like a literature and film class. She found a way to work it in that class as well. And she teaches a whole thing about Jung. She's really big into Jung and pop culture. We read The Dark Knight screenplay in that class. So she's really doing interesting stuff, but she always finds a way to work this in. And basically And also, I should say, I'm not an expert in Hopi, you know, religion or culture. I want to be more, and some of the things I'm going to share right now, I think, are really cool ideas, and I also have some real holy envy for this. But I'll dive into sort of what I learned in that class and in this paper, and then talk about how it kind of relates to Mormonism. But basically, the idea is that in the Hopi religion, there is this ceremony that the people do when they're growing up, and as they become an adult in the community, there's a ceremony that radically changes their fundamental understanding of the way that the universe works and the way that their religion works. They grow up with these gods that they have a very tangible relationship with. Gods appear to them, and I think they're the Kachinas is what they're called. And so there's they will be throughout a child's life, and they just kind of come to accept these gods as these real things. And then there's this, I think it's a week-long ceremony where these things happen to them. And most of what happens throughout the ceremony are like pain, like they're inflicted, or pain is inflicted upon them, and sort of some threats to never reveal or discuss what happens in these things with the people that haven't been initiated yet, with the children that haven't been initiated yet. And so it's a very physically, it's an ordeal physically, but people
and we're not saying we have holy envy for inflicting pain upon children, but the process that is about to happen is
So I mentioned the part about the pain because it plays a role here, but basically what happens, and it's the very end of this week or however long, at the very end of the ceremony, there's another thing that happens, which is that these gods appear, these Kachinas appear, and then all of a sudden, the gods unmask themselves and reveal themselves to be neighbors, aunts, uncles, people that the children know, and so it shatters their whole concept. It basically, it's like ripping the floor out from under them. And so when people like Sam Gill and others have interviewed initiates and asked them about this and learned about it, one thing that seems to be a pretty common thing is that the physical pain is nothing of that week compared to the emotional and spiritual devastation that happens. And then the ceremony ends kind of on a moment of discord and not having anything resolved. But the fascinating thing about this is that after this ceremony, the result seems to be that Hopi adults are very religious, and their spiritual life really begins after that moment of initiation. And so, you know, they're afraid to talk. Well, let me quote from the article here. So this is one Hopi woman talking that's quoted in the Sam Gill article. She said, "I cried and cried into my sheepskin that night, feeling I had been made a fool of. How could I ever watch the Kachinas dance again? I hated my parents, and I thought I would never believe the old folks again, wondering if gods had ever danced for the Hopi, as they said, and if people really lived after death. I hated to see the other children fooled and felt mad when they said I was a big girl now and should act like one. But I was afraid to tell the others the truth, for they might whip me to death. I know now it was the best and only way to teach the children, but it took me a long time to know that. I hope my children won't feel like that." So that's a pretty, you know, it's complex, certainly. As I've thought about, basically, it was, when I learned about this, it really opened my eyes to this, a lot of things. But the main thing is, wow, here's a religion that is actually intentionally inserting disenchantment into the scheme of things, into the person's life. And that, in fact, a person's religious experience and their spiritual life actually becomes richer after the experience of disenchantment. And I compared that to my experience in growing up Mormon, and from what I can perceive of the larger Christian culture, we don't really have anything, I would say, that is intentional disenchantment. But disenchantment still happens. It's just that we try to avoid it instead of trying to focus on it. So, you know, when talk about the holy envy, I certainly would want to like study more richly to really get a sense and stuff. I don't want to, you know, do a superficial job of telling this other culture. But so the pain, you know, I certainly am conflicted about all the value of this type of thing. But I'm fascinated and really inspired by this example of a religion that is, I would say, mature enough to actually acknowledge that disenchantment is part of it, that part of religious life is that some things are going to break, and that if you actually build it in rather than avoid it, that really helps.
Awesome.
Let me see. So, Sam Gill talks about this. He says this, the very nature of reality has become threatened. Each child must search out a new basis for perceiving a meaningful reality. And so that's interesting. I don't know, that's just kind of, that blew my mind that was an idea that exists.
And it wasn't just the Hopis. I mean, he mentioned right. Three or four other cultures I had certainly encountered in literature of Aboriginal folks in Australia and New Zealand, with the bull roar, things like that. So, and then, of course, you know, we even have this at a very small scale with Santa Claus. It's more, you know, that's probably the only kind of universal one here in the West that this sort of process happens, but it's not in a ritual way, and it's a conflicted society about whether this is, you know, was good to even tell them about that before or after. But
well, that's exactly where I went to, Dan. Like after I saw, I was like, how can I incorporate this into my experience? Like, okay, when I'm raising kids, I want to use Santa Claus as this thing where I not only tell them that Santa is real, but I you know, like dress up like Santa or do something to really make them believe it. And then one Christmas when they're a certain age or something, like just lay it out for them. But then turn it into a moment where now Christmas has a new meaning, where that you still get gifts. I mean, but they come from your parents who love you rather than this other person that, and you know,
you,
so I've,
you know,
I've
Derek, this idea of Santa actually plays out in Scandinavian culture as well. I don't know if you are aware of their Santa traditions, but Santa is almost always your dad, and he brings presents, you know, the night on Christmas Eve night. And yeah, it doesn't take kids getting very old before they start to notice an uncanny resemblance between Santa and their father. So
yeah, it's really interesting.
One of my favorite things was a niece that says, you know, it's really interesting that Santa and the Tooth Fairy have similar handwriting. It was starting to dawn on her.
Well, you know, I never believed in Santa. My parents had a strategy of, like, they never wanted to outright lie to me. And so because of that, and they defined it, you know, as, so they basically defined it as, if any of us ever asked outright, they would never outright say it. And I guess I was probably just mindlessly curious one day as like a 2-year-old. And I asked the question, my mom told me. So I don't have any memory of actually believing in a literal Santa, but, and I always appreciated that growing up. I always liked that, you know, my parents never told me anything that wasn't true. And that gave me a sense of security. But you know, now I wonder about that, and I wonder the value of intentionally, I don't know, messing it up a little bit. But
well, there's more to the Gill article, but Carl, I want to fold you in a little bit here, because partly what's happening here is the children had a religion that operated on a pretty literal level. These kachinas that came, and Derek was saying, they're kind of a part of the life of the village. Sometimes they were a little bit mean. Sometimes they brought presents. Some, you know, these kachinas, like I say, they were just, the children said, these are the gods or the ancestors, or I can't remember exactly what the language was, but the children were used to it. And that was their reality. And then this culture says, we need to now tell you about symbolic, you know, symbols pointing to deeper realities.
Yeah.
And Carly, a lot of your paper deals with that. Can you just do briefly a little bit about symbol and myth and stuff like that that kind of follows this little thread?
So first of all, I think it's worth pointing out that where the phrase or the term demythologizing or demythologization comes from. And it starts out that any religion in the course of in the process of going from its initial spark of revelation and inspiration to a routine, the famous sociologist Max Weber called the routinization of charisma, the charisma being the initial prophet or message, sometimes
spiritual
called
energy, though, of it,
yeah,
too. Yeah.
Yeah, the charism. And when this thing is translated into a routine, a process of mythologization occurs in which the original message accumulates more and more weight and more sort of magic, if you will. It becomes larger than life. The story gets better every time it's told. Lots of little sort of ritualistic or extra details get added to it, little accoutrements of mysticism and fascination that various believers have, and the whole process kind of gathers momentum. And this process is called mythologization, to where the original prophet or messenger or message becomes larger than life and gains an almost kind of godlike quality to it. And the process of demythologizing then is sort of peeling back the layers and getting to what the original story was like, or sort of trying to anyway, and trying to distinguish between aspects of the narrative that were based in some kind of original context and other things that have kind of been added later. And it's important to point out that the process of demythologization doesn't necessarily mean that you're discovering that these narratives are not true or that they're not literal in some way or another, but just that perhaps some aspects of them are different than you thought they were. Some interpretations may be different. They may even be based in historical fact of some kind or another. They usually are. You know, you look at stories of Jesus, stories of Muhammad. That most historians agree that Jesus and Muhammad were actual historical figures. But that doesn't mean that all of the things attributed to them also were a part of history. And in a larger sense, the ways that additional things get attributed to these figures almost start to shape and mold history. So there's a really interesting interplay between narrative and reality. So I hesitate to say that they're not real or literal in a certain sense, if you know what I'm saying there. But the process of demythologization is to sort of recognize these narratives for what they actually are and the purpose that they serve, the function that they serve.
But the reason for that recognition is going to lead to what? What's the payoff of that?
Yeah, so I would say, first of all, the process of demythologization begins when someone is faced with a struggle that because they've discovered a flaw in their worldview or their narrative. They've discovered challenges to these narratives, and they're trying to figure out what to make of them. And they have some choices. One choice might be that through perhaps some apologetics or some explanations from your spiritual leader, you might be able to kind of put the pieces back together and realize that these concerns you had were fairly minor and not a big deal. And that might tide you over for a while. Another approach that some people fall into is to go more heavily into fundamentalism, where they feel like these flaws that they're discovering in the narrative are lies or somehow invasions from an evil source, and the answer is to flee even further into a previous paradigm and just isolate themselves further from these disturbing other voices. And the choice that I really explore in detail is the choice that you kind of come to when the easy answers of your peers or your mentors no longer are sufficient to really resolve all of your concerns. And that's what Paul Tillich calls the process of breaking the myth. And for him, in his work, he was a famous theologian from the 20th century who left Nazi Germany and made a career for himself in the United States, and whose works used to be like used in the Religion 101 course of every major university. He talked about how to break a myth is not to discard it or get rid of it or stop practicing the things that you do in association with the myth, but to recognize it for what it is, to recognize it as a way of speaking about spiritual matters that are enduring and have lasting value, and not necessarily a literal explanation of everything. Once again, that doesn't mean that it's all fable as well. It just means that at least some aspects of the narrative that you've inherited from your upbringing are seen in a different light after you go through this process.
Yeah, and add one more part of your paper to this. Paul Tillich's famous for his term, the ultimate concern, and that people center their lives around ultimate concerns. But he says anything that really qualifies as a good ultimate concern, it can't be told in any other way than symbolically. Would you kind of fill in that gap?
Yeah, absolutely. So your ultimate concern for Paul Tillich, he basically says in his really great book, The Dynamics of Faith, that almost everybody in the world has faith, because he defines faith as an ultimate concern or whatever has ultimacy for you in your life. For an atheist, that might actually be your disbelief in God, the fact that you do not believe in God. That might be the way you construct your whole worldview around the absence of God. But that still is your ultimate concern. For someone who is very patriotic, their country might be their ultimate concern. And he talks about how whatever your ultimate concern is essentially becomes a god. It's the thing that your whole sense of worth and value revolves around. And God, whatever that god might be, is not something that can be just instantiated in front of you and easily grasped and touched and sensed with the five senses. And so instead of, we wouldn't be able to explain these ecstatic experiences that we have when we come in contact with something greater than us that defines our whole worldview. So what we use instead of any sort of tangible language or physical sensory language is we use symbolic terms. And symbols can take many forms. Symbols can be songs, they can be poetry, plays, movies, they can be scriptures, messages about divine, human encounters with the divine, and hymns, they can take various shapes, but each of these symbols serves to kind of wake us up, to break us open to new revelation, to new ideas and inspiration. And they, if they're functioning properly, they're pointing us toward our ultimate concern. But one of the things that Tillich points out is that a very common mistake is for us to fail to distinguish between the symbol and the thing that's being symbolized. And that this is at the core of some of our mythologization processes and what we need to start to understand if we're going to be breaking these myths and sort of moving to higher ground, I guess is what he would think of it as. So it's really important to recognize the difference between these. And if we fail to do this, we engage in a type of idolatry, because what we're essentially doing is mistaking God or the ultimate for the thing that's symbolizing or trying to point us to that. So we're assuming, for example, that the church, or which is another type of symbol one could look at, the organization or structure of the church, or the scriptures, the Bible, that they are somehow direct manifestations of God, his or herself, him or herself. And so when we think of them that way, when we think of them as infallible, inerrant, as God incarnate, essentially, we are mistaking the symbol for the thing that it's supposed to be pointing us to.
Awesome. Yep. And so it's an important process to, like you say, to wake us up, to change us. The Hopis and these other traditions have built it right in. And then I guess the assumption, the Gill article didn't really talk too much about it, Derek, is now that you're initiated, you could begin to have those conversations with your parents and with the elders, and they would slowly unfold the wisdom of what they've done by shocking you into the, you know, the new universe that you get, you know, thrust into.
That's right. Yeah, there's this wonderful quote in the Gill article where he says, "The initiation is constructed in such a way that a child's religious life begins in a state of seriousness and reflection motivated by doubt and skepticism."
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a powerful – I mean, personally, for me, doubt and skepticism and seriousness and reflection, I mean, those are the fruits of my personal sort of breaking apart that I had as, you know, a freshman at BYU. Yeah, it's once you are able to move past that that stage of the shock, then that's where the real fun begins.
Yeah. Now, Jordan, I want you to jump in here. Now, with the Hopi example and things like that, we did talk about the painfulness of this. You deal all the time with people whose, for whatever reason, their life isn't working, as well as their worldviews aren't working and things like this. Mm-hmm. And a part of your whole job is to get them to kind of hold these beliefs differently and stuff. What parallels do you see in the Tillich material and even this Native American stuff to good therapy or, you know, helping somebody on a more mature path? Is that the way to go? Or what's a good phrase? Or
sure. Let me, well, one thing I'm thinking of, and perhaps this will answer the question. We'll see if it does. But I've been thinking about, through what Derek and Carl are talking about, I've been thinking about empathy and how, you know, that's a big part of what you do as a therapist, and hopefully as a person, as a friend, as a brother or a spouse or whatever roles you play in your life. But a lot of our training as therapists is to really learn how to empathize with people who are going through a lot of, you know, pathology and a lot of problems. And that kind of empathy that's really embodied and contextual kind of requires you to step out of your own framework and into another person's. And you get used to doing that a lot. And it's while, you know, maintaining a sense of self at the same time. And so what I'm thinking here, what's kind of brought to my mind is, there's Carl Rogers, who's you know, a psychotherapist who was a humanist and really influential as a therapist, and passed away now. But he talked about empathy as hearing the music under the words. So you have the content of someone's words, but empathy is when you're hearing someone deeply and you're able to express that. And I'm trying to see how this ties in, but I think with kind of both Carl and Derek are talking about, there's sometimes we get so caught up in the content of our stories or our beliefs or our doubts that we're missing the mark of how the content and how the lived experience affects us and how it lives in our lives. And that might be the music under the words, you know, kind of going back to what Carl said about the symbol and what the symbol is actually pointing at. And this isn't maybe quite answering your question, but you know it was on my mind and thought I'd get it out there. In terms of how, you know, working with people who, you know, their worldview is collapsing. You know, most of my clients are coming from out of state. It's a treatment center where they're coming from out, and they're not having faith crises in the sense that a lot of Mormons who are talking on the internet are having them. Their crises are more about themselves and their sense of self and who am I and can I have a life worth living? You know, do I deserve to be sober and do, you know, more of a sense of self. I do think it's related, but the content is different. And what we try to do is help people to not be driven by their pain, their choices aren't driven by their reaction to pain or discomfort, but rather helping people hold their pain differently, their discomfort, their confusion, their anxieties or their depressive thoughts. And rather than kind of extinguishing those symptoms, help people become more flexible in the face of them and help people make their choices and their actions in their life based more on what they really cherish and what's really important to them, what's really vital to them. And I think this works with paradigm shifts too. Oftentimes in life, the things that concern us in the world or the source of our anxieties or our doubts or our confusions change. And yet underneath our kind of core values don't change as much. They might change, but usually our core values, it might be love, it might be integrity, it might be respect or loyalty. Those kinds of like qualitative values don't change as much. And so from a clinical perspective, you know, it seems for me to work with clients who it might not be faith issues, but also in my own life, and I have worked with some people with these kinds of faith crises, it seems to help to focus in that way where we're helping them build what we call psychological flexibility, this ability to act from your place of chosen values rather than being directed by your pain. And this is where I like the concept of faith transitions more than faith crises. And I know that people experience things as crises as well. And it seems like the disenchantment model might be more of a crisis. And so there's probably some function to that kind of a violent disenchantment. And yet in my life, it's been nice that my experience of faith has been kind of ongoing faith transitions that definitely painful at times, and also able to usually seems to be productively pointing me what I feel to be towards, the figure of Christ. And I think I think if we're in a place of kind of expecting faith to be uncomfortable and painful, it might help us just find opportunities for growth and for shifts and paradigm shifts and understanding kind of other paradigms and things like that. Those are a few of my thoughts. And yeah.
You know, one of the things that I'm wondering about as I try to raise my own children is to what extent it's good or bad to sort of precipitate a faith crisis in your kids in the sense that the Hopis do, or how much you should just sort of coddle them a little bit. Maybe that's the wrong word for it, but just sort of like shield them a little bit and help them gradually kind of work into these things. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that.
that's a great question. It is.
Yeah, I've been one of those who, at least I think it worked well with my kids, to like just always signal that I'm somebody you can talk to and then let it come up organically, you know, through their different personalities at different times in their lives and conversations that they had. So I tend to not be like trying to do that, but I know parents that do the other. So
no, that's helpful. Yeah, I've sort of taken a similar approach.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the things thinking about paradigms and how could I say this? I don't know. I mean, I know we are, you know, we're taught that we should teach our children and that we should try to use the Spirit to do that and teach them the best we can and teach them out of love and example and those things. And I find that those things work when I do them, and when I don't, you know, I need to try to do better. And I'm also aware that I guess part of my own shifting faith has been that I feel increased faith in Christ and in the power of his, you know, of Christ's atonement and love, and that we can access that and we can be that for each other. And I guess I feel a decrease in certainty that my paradigm or the way I experience it, the way I can describe it to people, is something I should be kind of forcing on people or kind of trying to kind of manipulate in a certain way, even on my own kids. So I kind of feel like life is going to be is going to be, you know, have rough edges. They're going to learn things, whether through church or through myself, that later I'll, like, who'd you hear that from? And it might be from me, and I might be concerned about that. But I think it's just, it's going to be, it's not going to be perfect. There's no perfect way to do parenting, and we need all the help we can get.
Yeah, thanks. That's really good. I struggle. I was just going to say, I struggle personally with sort of at what point is it good to sort of acknowledge idolatry when you see it, to sort of speak out against it Jesus style, you know, the way he occasionally was quite pointed and sharp against those who expressed religious arrogance in certain forms, or who were so convinced that they possessed some sort of direct connection, you know, to God, and or to take the more gentle approach of just sort of allowing each person to come to these points in their faith journey on their own, you know, and or what kind of balance to strike there. It's a constant struggle. It's an ongoing struggle for me personally.
Yeah, and it's hard for me to think about it, because, you know, I see harm in withholding, you know, the truth, whatever, you know, the facts or whatever it is that I might think of as the truth. But then I also see harm in withholding the symbols and the myths, you know. It's really tough to think through.
Mm-hmm. What there may be some things I could share in Tillich's work that kind of inform this as well is Paul Tillich describes two types of literalism, the natural literalism and the reactive literalism. And he says that the natural literalism, or natural stage of literalism, is something that every person has to go through in their faith journey and upbringing, and that it shouldn't be actively disturbed. But that when a person comes to the point where they're personally asking questions and not finding all the answers that they want, that at that point, the legitimate choice, or the valid and appropriate choice, is to begin the process of demythologization or breaking myths. Sometimes those who resist this process, either by sort of ignoring the concerns that they have or suppressing them, or through preventing others from exploring these concerns personally. So if a church leader or someone in a position of authority tells someone to stop thinking about that and stop reading that kind of stuff and just get it out of your mind, he calls that stage reactive literalism, and he does criticize that and feels that it's inappropriate and wrong.
Yeah, definitely. Now I'm torn here, because we're in some ways, you know, we have an adult audience listening here, and certainly there's, you know, the issue of training our children, or, you know, how do we introduce this as a healthy stage, you know, for our children. But I still want to play a little bit longer with our own personal pain. You know, we're not building it. We haven't built it in at age, you know, 10 to 12, like the Hopis or something, where we're going to get this reality shocked here. But we're also not dealing with Santa Claus here. We're not dealing with, you know, a jolly elf and this and that. So we're talking about God. We're talking about salvation. We're talking about the entire meaning of life and the way I've oriented my life. And I've made so many decisions, and I've, you know, for many people who are struggling, it's, I've denied myself XYZ pleasures, and now you're telling me it's not true, and that, you know, Mormons don't have the entire universe figured out and stuff like that. And so there's this incredible pain that is happening here. Is there anything in these materials to help that, or is this just something that we just need to simply say, we get it, we've, you know, Jordan, you said it never really quite, it was that difficult for you. I'm not positive it was for me, but we all know that it can be that traumatic for some who are listening here. So any advice there, as into terms of, like, okay, guys, you're listening to this podcast, you've probably been disenchanted in some way. You know, you've begun this process of demythologization. Sell it to us about why ultimately this, you know, don't go back into reaction, what'd you call it, Carl, the Tillich phrase,
reactive
of literalism. And I know that James Fowler uses Tillich too, and there's this stage where sometimes you say, you know, with Fowler it was like, okay, I've taken a look at stage four and I'm going back, and he called it a willed naivete. As an act of will, I'm going to stay in my naive state. How do we keep people from thinking that's a good option?
Well, one thing that comes to mind, Dan, I think is that it's a kind of impossible. I suppose it is possible to have the willed naivete and to force that on yourself, but I don't know how sustainable that is. Learning something, you know, eating the fruit of knowledge, it's kind of hard to go back to the garden after that happens because it's just a natural consequence, you know? But I do think it's interesting that we've, in our discussion so far, I think we've sort of laid out that there are different models of disenchantment, and that the degree to which it's painful has a lot to do with sort of privilege in some sense of the things that were. I know, Dan, you've really nicely talked about how you're really thankful to have been able to spend a lot of time in grad school and things like that. And I think for some people, the pain that is associated with this type of thing is really about circumstance and where you are. I know for me, being in college, I feel really lucky in a lot of ways. But yeah, anyway, this first thought.
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation because, you know, in many cases, people are exposed to new information, depending on their upbringing, they can see that new information as challenging but reconcilable, or they can see it as sort of damning evidence that is a complete repudiation of everything they've been taught, right? And I think which way they look at things often depends a lot on how strictly hardcore and conservative their upbringing was, and how literally they've been taught to interpret things. And I think that the more literally they've been taught, the more difficult it becomes. So for example, I was raised, and I'm sure many other people were raised, to believe that evolution and the gospel were irreconcilable. I was exposed later on to, you know, believing people who still accepted evolution and had to seriously grapple with that. And eventually I came to different conclusions than I had been taught during my upbringing. But that was certainly a more difficult transition than someone who's raised in an environment where they don't feel the necessity of deciding between those two options, or thinking of those as a dichotomy.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. If I didn't know quite you're finished right there. So it is. You're right. It's so much dependent on your circumstances, your own temperament, the temperament of your parents. If you know you're. We have the great two images of the iron rod versus the Liahona. If you're comfortable with just pointing me in the right direction, or if you want to be told step by step, I think there is a reaction to it.
You know, Dan, well, this also might be a good moment to insert this, that we have to. I always feel a sense of wanting to be careful when talking about sort of disenchantment, and especially talking about adult religious experience, because I have such a belief in it. I want everybody to learn, and but everybody's experience is so different, and something feels off to me when I start sort of putting myself, the state that I've come to, as above others, or you know, and things like that. I know that that's something we all kind of have to wrestle with. I don't know how relevant that is, but maybe this would be a good time to insert that when we're talking about these new stages, we're not putting down other stages, or we're not saying that everybody has to come to the conclusions that I've come to, or that you've come to, or that you and I are even have to have come to the same conclusions.
I definitely would second that and say that one thing that I feel very strongly about is that different stages of faith enable different types of capabilities in individuals. And some things that are quite, you often see very remarkable behavior and accomplishments in people who have a very literal faith, you know. And in some ways, you know, human beings have made marvelous achievements, sometimes tremendous sacrifices, partly because of how strongly they believed in a certain cause. And I often find that it's very common for someone who's gone through a faith crisis to have a struggle a little more to come up with the motivation to do things that previously were easier for them, you know. And so there are definitely pros and cons to each of these phases, and I think that it's important not to consider them as being like a constant upward sort of journey.
Right. So what are the pros and the cons of welcoming the disenchantment or the demythologizing?
Yeah, so pros and cons of disenchantment of I really like the last podcast I was on with Adam Miller, and I like his discussion of faith as a process of kind of peeling back our stories. And so that's kind of where we're inflicting this kind of skepticism or disenchantment on ourselves, in a sense. Where it, to me, it fits, it is the message of Christ. He's asking us to remove the beam out of our eye. He's, you know, we're supposed to ask ourselves, what lack I yet? And I think those things aren't just about, oh, what sin did I commit today? But it's also, in what ways can I acknowledge that I'm looking at my brothers and sisters here and the world through a glass darkly? And it's, you know, that scripture in Corinthians where Paul talks about how we see through a glass darkly. It's interesting that is in the very same epistle or the portion where he talks about charity being the enduring gift of the Spirit. And so I think he's talking really about how our need to love each other in the way that Christ loved, in this way where you subvert the power of the symbol of Christ, you know, whether historical or metaphorical, is that he subverts this power, and that the least become the greatest, that the vulnerable in our society become those who we prove our devotion and our righteousness through serving them and through sacrificing for them. And I think that has to do internally too with our own thoughts and our own experiences, that sometimes we get really caught up in certainty about certain things, and then we're kind of neglecting marginalized voices within ourselves. And this, for me, I really resonate with both what Derek and Carl were saying about this. It's difficult as we're trying to be faithful to not, when the faith and doubt and the paradigms that we're working with really work for us, of course we feel emboldened and we feel like we want to evangelize and we want to bring other people to this place that we are. We've reached the mountaintop, and it's kind of like that pride cycle thing where we're all of a sudden maybe closing our ears to other people. And it's, to me, it's just this kind of continuing process of listening, of hearing, of learning, of building faith, and then of recognizing when we're becoming arrogant or too sure, and we've stopped listening, and then we kind of return and repeat that again. And this is why I think the covenants and the rituals and all these things are so, so vital to this process of, you know, becoming a community together.
You know, one other thing that I wanted to mention here is that I think it's really important to sort of add additional layers about this mythologization or demythologization process, and point out that what we're moving on to is not necessarily entirely metaphorical. In a sense, it may even motivate us to do things more, to make a bigger difference in the here and now in our present everyday lives. It may provide us with certain driving forces that that really help us actually to be more productive in our lives. And I was recently reading a blog post by Nathaniel Givens about how, he was talking about how he needs something more than metaphor, we have this promise of a physical resurrection. We have very literalistic claims that many religions make. Mormonism is one of them. And the question sometimes I think we should ask ourselves is, do we really believe in these, and how much? And as we go through this process of disenchantment, do we discard all of it? Do we keep some of it? Does it take on a different form? For me, my part of my inspiration and motivation towards founding the Mormon Transhumanist Association was almost, in a sense, a more literal rendition of some of the promises of Mormonism, but in a different form, in a way. So I just want to point that out, that the process of disenchantment and demythologization doesn't necessarily mean that everything becomes wishy-washy, if that makes sense.
I think you're right on with that, Carl. I think, when I think about the millennium, one thing that kind of works for me, it's maybe a little heuristic device, is I feel like I have these different parts of me. I have my true believing self. I have my agnostic self. I have my, more atheist self. And I can kind of step into the sandbox and look at it from that. This is kind of, I think, where the empathy thing comes in, where you can understand a version of that really makes sense and step back and forth. And when I step into that more agnostic self, oftentimes I feel more committed to doing the things I should be doing as a Mormon. Interestingly enough, because when I think of the millennium as more metaphorical, let's say, or Zion as something that or Christ's coming as something that's more metaphorical, then I feel a bigger burden on one sense to what part do I need to do to help this world become a peaceful place, to realize the myth.
But now, did it take you a while to get to that point, Jordan? Because that's, I agree with you. That's probably been my life the last 10 years, but the first 10 or 15 weren't that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I would say I'm not settled on that, and I don't. Maybe I will, but I'm saying that's kind of a sandbox I go to, and then I come, because I think there are things that are beneficial. Part of my, faith over the past few years have been integrating other truths I find in other religions, and Eastern religions, and Buddhism, and these other religions have been really influential to me personally, but also in my practice, where in therapeutic practice, if you guys have followed the trends in psychotherapy, mindfulness meditation is everywhere. It's huge, and I love it. It's something that's really transformed my professional life as a therapist and my personal life as a religious person. And there's so many principles there that are principles of not doing, there's a kind of virtue to even stepping back and waiting. Now, on the flip side, we could go too far, and that could be kind of a lack of courage and a slothful servant kind of thing, or I'm lacking the courage of my convictions to do something that I need to. I really think there's this balance between what is offered from this kind of a literal belief and a metaphorical belief. What I would say, though, is where I feel like I have settled is that the important questions, when I really like go to my knees and pray, the important questions aren't, was Jesus Christ a historical figure, or was the Book of Abraham, really translated in, or those aren't the important questions. The important questions are, God, what do you want me to do today? How do you want me to help my family? What do you want me to do? And what's literally true is that the function of God in my life is more important than me somehow proving or disproving a corresponding reality of God out there.
Can I submit something? Sorry, go ahead, Dan.
Well, I just say ultimately I think the church would agree with you, but yet it is so heavily emphasized on the truth, knowing the truth, believing the truth somehow saves you. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I think you could sell what you just said to somebody as the deeper, as the more profound, as, you know, the grown-up way of interacting with your life. But I'm not sure that we get that much help in the church, and that's where I want to go the second half of this podcast, mm-hmm. more about mm-hmm. how our church could, you know, transform in some of these ways and make more strides. But Derek, go ahead and jump in.
Yeah, so the thing that I want to throw in is that what is the most important question, I think, is going to be different, and it's really going to depend on the circumstance. And I think I can foresee, or I can see somebody where the most important question that they could be asking is, was there a literal Jesus? Because maybe their faith is based on that. You know, I guess for me, in my experience, the chipping away of the particular things that I needed to chip away from may be different for other people. And I think the end goal, or one of the end goals, hopefully, should be that I like the idea of pragmatism and the idea of what's pragmatic. But I also think there's really a lot of value in putting up some questions that are purely hypothetical and really giving them the full, you know, the full investigation, because there's things that can come from that investigation that I think are really valuable.
So bracket the truth claims about it and just dive in as if it were hypothetical stuff.
I guess I would say I've found a lot of value in following where it is that I'm most wondering about, or what it is that I'm most concerned about. And so, you know, there certainly are a lot of issues that I just don't have a lot of problems with. And those aren't really the areas that I need to study, I think. But I think the areas that I have a lot of concerns about, I found value in diving into those and really investigating, even if they're less pragmatic and a little bit more just about the claims themselves.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. The other thing I want to add, Dan, is that metaphor, I want to make a distinction between metaphor as a model for truth and metaphor as sort of the wishy-washy explanation, you know, that's kind of just, because metaphor is the reason that it's lasted, I think, so long in the human history is that it's really powerful. And in fact, for some things, there just isn't a way to access the truth without metaphor.
And right. That's what we were talking about earlier with Tillich and symbols. That ultimate concern has to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Talked around.
Yeah. We see it in science as well, right? There are scientific models for things that you learn as a, you know, entry-level science student. And then two courses later, you discover that all of that was just a metaphor. Or, you know, the atom, you thought the atom was one way, and then, you know, later you learn that that was just a metaphor for what it really is. And you don't do that because, you know, it's not like a wasted class where you learned about the atom that first way. It's, you need metaphor to wrap your brain around things. And I think spiritual truth is one of those things that is really hard to pin down, especially rationally, but it's not to say that it's not true, and it's not to say that it's not just as tangible and real. It's just that it kind of depends on metaphor. So, but at the same time, I think sometimes people can be sloppy in the metaphors and just making stuff up as they go along. And certainly, religion has a whole helping, you know, of both. But I think that metaphor. I don't want us to throw metaphor under the bus at all for that.
And are you reacting in some ways to what Carl described as Nathaniel Given saying, I want something more than metaphor. I want a literal resurrection, etc.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I'm saying that there's kind of an interplay between those different levels of reality, I guess. I felt that Nathaniel Givens was being slightly reductionist in his distinction between what he called abstractions and metaphors, because you know, I think that there are way well. I use the example to him in response to his post of that a famous quote by Dominique Crossan, where he said essentially, like, some people say that they would never really do anything for a metaphor, and he says, on the contrary, the only thing that I would do anything for is a metaphor. Like, right. He said, like, I don't care anything for a piece of real estate from Mexico to the Canadian border, but I would certainly die for my country. Mm-hmm. And what he meant by that was that there is this narrative that we have of the country we belong to that is at the heart of our everything we hold dear. And that narrative is really playing into what motivates us to do things in life and to get out of bed in the morning and do all these other things. And the actual physical reality, whatever that might be, is actually not what is motivating us in our day-to-day activities.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.